Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang Thammang Sangkhang Khunuttarang Upacchayang Namasami. One of my favorite exercises, and one that I'm going to share with you and recommend you try for yourself, is to imagine you have a guest from Mars or Venus or any other planet, really. But the idea being that this is someone from another planet who's very intelligent but knows nothing at all about this world and our life in it. And that you then have to explain your life and the things you do and the things around you and why things are the way they are to this visitor from Mars. It's a very good way of questioning, re-examining, recognizing all that you take for granted. And this came to mind earlier on this afternoon, speaking with some students. And one of the students said, "I hear that you keep an awful lot of rules. Is that true?" And I said, "Yes, I mean hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rules. But it doesn't seem it's not a pressure upon me to do that, or I don't feel that it's constricting me in any way." And to clarify this point, I suggested this imaginary guest or friend from Mars and said, let's say you set yourself the task of explaining to this Martian all about driving a car. You know, what is a car? How do you drive it? And what are the conventions involved? What are the do's and the don'ts? And I think that before very long, you realize you were describing a huge number of rules. Every time you drive a car, you keep so many rules. Some of them are backed up by the laws of the land and the highway code. Others are more conventions or enable you to drive more safely or more efficiently or effectively. But I would doubt whether anyone feels that when they drive a car, they're taking on a huge number of rules and regulations which are very constricting and suffocating. And this is how a monk feels about his discipline, or a nun. It feels the same way that you feel about driving a car. Another analogy I'll share with you is that of a musician playing, let's say, a concerto by one of the great composers, say Beethoven or Mozart or whoever. And we are very impressed and appreciative of the skill and the creativity of the musician, violinist or pianist or whatever. And we rarely, I think, consider that every single movement of the musician's fingers or whatever he's using, his lips, his lungs, whatever, was laid down by, is determined by someone who died 200 or 300 or whatever years ago. Again, I bring this up as an example because I think it's very a clear example of someone who is putting forth effort in a way which is dependent on conforming to a number of huge number of conditions voluntarily, and yet rather than feeling diminished by that, feels that it's the most beautiful expression of its freedom as an artist or as a creator, and similarly for all those who listen. So this understanding of sila and morality is very important and central to our understanding of our practice as Buddhists. The path of practice, traditionally formulated in terms of the Eightfold Path, is often abbreviated into three kinds of training or education, or sikha. First, the training or education of conduct, training or education of the heart, training education of our understanding of life. So the Buddhist teachings are then, I would argue, fundamentally, they form fundamentally an education system rather than a belief system. And this, for this reason, I would say that we could argue, or I would argue, that Buddhism is a universal religion, in that most belief system religions find it impossible to avoid division between us and them. We who have the correct set of beliefs and everyone else who does not. And then are faced with the dilemma of how do you behave towards people who've got it all wrong and are going to suffer for eternity because of that lack of faith. Do you try to persuade them? Do you try to force them? Do you ignore them? This is a major dilemma, I think, for anyone who takes a belief system religion seriously. In Buddhism, we say what you believe is not so important about how you live your life. And those conditions that promote or lead to rebirth in a heaven realm are such things as kindness, generosity, integrity, compassion, and so on. All those virtues are the driving force that leads to a favorable rebirth and ultimately to freedom from the whole cycle of rebirth. And for this reason, wherever a Buddhist sees goodness and kindness and compassion and generosity and integrity and honesty, Buddhist rejoices. Because that person is creating the conditions for happiness for themselves in this life and in future life, completely independent, irrespective of whether they might be call themselves or consider themselves Christians or Muslims or Mormons or Hindus or whatever. The religious label, the beliefs, are secondary to conduct, to inner and outer conduct. So Buddhism, for this reason, has never been an evangelical religion, but it's one in which Buddhists seek to support the creation and the growth of goodness in whatever society they find themselves. And are tolerant of those of different beliefs in the midst of their own countries and communities. So Buddhism is they say essentially a training or an education of the whole of our life. And it is not merely a cultural identity that is a sad waste of a human life if we take on Buddhism merely as an external form, but don't embark upon this education with which the Buddha bequeathed us. So in this threefold training or education of sila, of the heart, and of wisdom, it's important to understand that this is what we these days would call a holistic education. That is to say, it's not step by step, or that you can't take one part of the education and develop it out of context. Indeed, in the practice of sila, or the conduct, the education, training of conduct, the heart and wisdom education is always there in the background. It's just that in certain circumstances, the sila or education of conduct, or what's generally referred to as morality, takes the leading role. And the other two elements are in a supporting role. In those most Buddhist students, those of you, most of you will know that the second leg of this, or element of this training, is usually called samadhi. But it's important to understand here that the word samadhi, as the second of the three kinds of education, is used in a different sense to that used in sama samadhi, the eighth leg of the, it's part of the Eightfold Path, where it refers specifically to the inner tranquility and clarity and stillness and stability of mind produced by meditation practice. In the threefold training, this word is used to cover all of the different elements of the education of the heart. So all the ways in which we seek to deal creatively and effectively with negative mental states such as anger and lust and greed and jealousy and depression and anxiety and fear and so on, and how we cultivate all the wholesome mental states of kindness and compassion and contentment and patience and resilience and effort and so on and so forth. So samadhi is an umbrella term in the threefold trainings rather than a specific technical term referring to meditation. And so for this reason, I prefer to use the training of the heart rather than samadhi to avoid any misunderstanding. So in that training of the heart, education of the heart, then the training in morality and in wisdom or understanding is also present, but in a supporting role. The development of wisdom, the sila and the samadhi, the morality and the training of the heart are also present in a supporting role. It's just a difference of prominence, and whichever area of the training is appropriate, most appropriate at any particular moment. So this is a very unusual attitude to morality when we compare it with the usual idea of morality as conforming to a set of rules laid down by a deity which are backed up by a system of reward and punishment. In Buddhism, then we have the recognition that we, as human beings, we cannot, through an act of will, prevent unkind, cruel, jealous, nasty thoughts from arising in our mind. And we'd go crazy if we thought we should, full of guilt, because it's not something that's possible. But what we can do, and it's not too high and too idealistic a standard at all, is that we can make a commitment to not expressing those kinds of volition in our actions or speech. So when we take the precepts, informal precept ceremonies, the lay Buddhists request the precepts from the monk. This is very important because it has to be voluntary. This is an expression of the voluntary nature of this education. Each of the precepts, when translated accurately into English, involves a phrase, I undertake the education of my conduct involved in abstaining from harming or hurting or stealing or sexual misconduct or whatever. So it's a commitment to an education. And once we have that commitment to an education of our conduct, then it's a standard that we have with us and forms what I call a peg for mindfulness. It enables us to awaken to how we are acting, the quality of our actions in daily life. It enables us to refrain from certain actions and to act in other ways. Now the goal of this education, immediate goal, is to create trust and warmth and stability and a sense of safety in communities, beginning with families and going all the way up to the larger society. Now, if in any kind of community, if we humbly recognize that ourselves and those around us may well on occasions be angry and upset and be greedy and jealous and all these things, and we don't expect that they shouldn't be or don't think that we should not be that way, and yet we can take responsibility for our actions. And we are confident that those around us will do that also. We feel safe. We don't have to be always on our guard. We don't have to be defensive and protective and suspicious. We relax. We feel good because we trust those around us. So when you see the beauty of trust, in any kind of relationship, from a relationship between in a couple, between a man and woman, a man and man, woman and woman, whatever, between two people, or in a family, or in a community, as soon as there's that sense of trust, then you have something very stable and worthwhile. And that sense of trust doesn't come by itself. It comes immediately when you have a shared voluntary commitment to creating certain boundaries for your actions and speech, and saying, this is my choice, and I want to train myself in this way. So keeping precepts is considered to be bun, or punya, is merit, because you're giving harmlessness to the world, you're enabling people to feel safe, and valued and loved, because you are taking responsibility for your actions and speech, and making that intention not to shout and to steal and to be aggressive and to hurt those around or to hurt yourself. Now, internally, the important feature of Buddhist morality is, as an education training, then there are also certain other features that must be fulfilled. One is that there is no gaining attitude in mind. You're not keeping precepts in order to get something, whether it might be a present moment reward of praise or respect or status or a heavenly reward in the future. So here is where the training of the heart comes in very clearly. It's not just keeping precepts, but you have to constantly be reflecting and protecting the heart from any gaining ideas that might arise. And secondly, the Buddha said that if you lead a careful and restrained and respectful life, you keep precepts, and then on the grounds of that pure sila, you look down on others who behave badly, and you consider yourself superior to them. By that very idea, by that very, or indulging in that idea and welcoming that idea, your sila is sullied. So the moment that you take this, I'm better than they are because of my pure sila, your pure sila becomes impure. So it's a subtle training of the heart as well as of conduct. The result which we aspire to is that through experiences in which we are under pressure or we are tempted to act or speak badly or unwisely, and we are nevertheless able to maintain our commitment to precepts, we feel a sense of self-confidence, and we start to feel we really like ourselves. So this sense of self-respect and liking ourselves is, the Buddha suggests, I'm suggesting you don't take this obviously as an object of faith, but look at this, just how your perception of yourself changes. You like yourself. And if you're going to develop meditation in a way that leads to wisdom and liberation, you have to be good friends with yourself. It doesn't work otherwise. And this is why sila is so fundamental. So you need to keep sila, you need to have the right understanding, you need to understand why breaking each precept is a cause of suffering to yourself and to others. You have to see the beauty, the value of each precept, and really aspire and want to keep the rule. And you need to be patient. If you lack patience, even if you you accept a standard of conduct and you have some commitment towards it, but the moment you feel uncomfortable or bored or hot or cold or hungry or thirsty or tired, you forget it, then you're never going to go very far on the path. Patience is the supreme virtue in the Avada Patimokkha, and the key discourses that the Buddha gave it to the 1,250 fully enlightened monks and the year following his enlightenment. So this wasn't a teaching telling monks the path to Nibbana, because they'd already reached that goal. So this was laying down the fundamental principles of the teaching so that those arahants could use it as a framework in teaching in whatever part of Middle India or whatever part of the world they should wander to. And so the Buddha pointed to the Nibbana as being the highest goal, and of all the different virtues that would lead on that path, he singled out patient endurance. Kanti paramang tapo titika. patience is the supreme incinerator of defilements. And it's worth coming back to this teaching, because it's not one that I think is emphasized enough. And often, even in communities of monks and meditation monks, often patience is relegated to a kind of consolation prize. I did this retreat or I did this practice. I didn't really get that much. Well, I guess I got a bit of patience out of it. It's like better than nothing. It's this consolation prize. But patience is the prize itself. This is the Buddha's words. The development of patience is supreme incinerator of defilements. So that isn't. But again, there is a proviso, you recognize that you can never ever take one single virtue out of context. It's this living organic training. So even patience is the supreme virtue. But it also has to be governed by wisdom. Many monks of my generation, young Westerners, gung-ho, we arrive in the jungles of northeast Thailand and we're going to go for it, and we all got to sit cross-legged and for hours on end, and never mind the mosquitoes, and we're going to do this, And number of monks ended up having to go and have operations on their knees. Because they were very tough, very highly motivated, but that's not all you need. You need a certain common sense and patience. And so, patience. What does patience mean? Well, one of the best definitions of this that I've come across is given by Lumpur Sumato, one of the senior monk in our tradition, and he said, patience is peaceful coexistence with the unpleasant. So patience doesn't mean you're gritting your teeth, and just keep looking at the clock. That's not patience. That's not what the Buddha is talking about. It's being able to be at peace with something that you don't like or something you don't want or something that is unpleasant. So that sense of peaceful acceptance that, this is unpleasant. I don't like this. But I'm not going to allow my mind to be affected by it. I'm just being bearing with it. So that's an important virtue. When I was when I first arrived in Thailand in 1978, and Northeast Thailand is a very sticky kind of climate, has a very sticky kind of climate in some seasons when you walk you feel like you're swimming through the air, and it's and we have to sit on this concrete floor, and when I first arrived I didn't speak the language, of course, and everyone has to sit papier, in the side posture. And I'd been sitting cross-legged for a couple of years by then. I was sort of all ready to go, but I'd never sat this is papier, very nice papier. And it's really, it's like, if it doesn't feel balanced, you're a twist to one side. And before you've been sitting there very long, you want to change. And you can't sit cross-legged and you can't get up. And the mosquitoes are biting. And and you just have to be patient. Anyway, I'd hear these very long talks from Ajahn Chah, and I couldn't understand anything. And then you just pick up this certain word you hear again and again. And I remember after the same time there was a Western monk, Australian monk, who was like a Pi Liang, he's like a friend and mentor. And I said, I'd like to start learning Thai as quickly as I can. If there's some words I hear, can I ask you? And he said, yeah. And he said, well, there is this word I just hear all the time, and Ajahn Chah seems to say, "Oh, what's that word? Ot ton. What does that mean? Ot ton, ot ton." And he said that means patient endurance. And I said, "Oh, okay, now I understand." So being patient is a very important part of the training. And when you see this training as this organic whole, as I said, you're training in conduct and bringing a sense of care and attention to the quality of your actions and quality of your speech, then you can learn so much. The effort to be mindful of speech is so illuminating. Yet so many of the negative emotions express themselves in our speech, often without our being aware of it. And bringing that light of awareness onto speech helps us to see our minds, our hearts much more clearly. And it's a very important part of the training. Now, the aspect of Buddhism which is most immediately appealing to many people is that of meditation practice. But the understanding of meditation practice tends to be very narrow. People tend to think meditation is, that's what the real Buddhist practice is, and you sit with your eyes closed or you walk up and down, that's Buddhist practice. But in actual fact, what I would like to share with you is that the best framework for understanding Buddhist practice is in fact what we call the four right efforts. So let's look at a typical meditation session. What are you doing when you're meditating? You're putting attention on the breath or on a word or whatever. But looking at slightly from a different angle, first thing you're doing is you're trying to sustain attention in such a way that negative mental states such as desires and aversions and laziness and dullness and agitation and doubts don't engulf the mind. And on those, and when that's not successful, and you find you're meditating, you've got sleepy, or you're agitated, or you've got all these thoughts about what you're going to eat when you leave here, or it's going around your mind, then you have to have put forth effort, wise effort. You must have strategies with which to deal with those hindrances, with those negative mental states that have arisen. So you're putting effort to protect the mind from negative mental states and to deal with negative mental states that have arisen. You are also seeking to cultivate positive emotions, obviously mindfulness, clear comprehension, effort, contentment with the meditation object, and perhaps the loving kindness or compassion. Most specifically, you're seeking to develop what we call the enlightenment factors or the bojangas or the jhana factors. So these are in meditation, the bojangas or enlightenment factors, the jhana factors are the wholesome mental states that you're seeking to cultivate. And when they have started to arise in the mind, your effort is to nurture them and to bring them to maturity. So meditation is effort. It's putting forth effort to protect the mind from unarisen negative mental states, to prevent their arising. It is the effort to deal with negative mental states that have already arisen. It's the effort to create and to bring into the mind positive mental states that have not yet arisen, and to cultivate and to further nourish and to bring to maturity those mental states, positive mental states that have arisen. Now, in practice and daily life, I just don't have any time to meditate. Life's so busy. By the time I've been to send a few messages with Line, and I've done my Facebook, and I've done this, there's just no time left for meditation. Life's so busy. And the sense of frustration, and maybe I can take a few days off work and go off to a monastery or a meditation retreat and really get my practice together again. And you know, if it wasn't for my husband, my wife, my work, my dog, then I would be peaceful, you know. So there's always someone or something to blame. But then if we just change our attitude and look at our practice in terms of the four right efforts, we say, yeah, there's always, whatever you are, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whoever you're with, you can always put forth one of those four efforts. So in the morning, going to work, you know, preventing, what are the unwholesome dhammas that can easily arise in your mind during the day? You just think about this beforehand. What do any negative mental states arise when you're driving to work? You know, when you're in traffic jams or when somebody drives in a very inconsiderate manner. What's your usual mental state on the way to work? Are there any negative mental states that tend to arise? So how can you protect your mind against them? Or when you get to work or during the day, you know, and you do get upset and hurt feelings and frustration and anger and tension, and what strategies do you have? What have you developed? What resources do you have to deal with those? Or do you just try to get away from them with some pleasure or just to forget them? Now we have an unprecedented ability to escape from problems. And we have more and more atrophied and weaker capacity to deal with problems. In the moment we have even the slightest amount of boredom or anxiety or depression or something, you know, immediately we have a way out. Smartphone, or get in touch with somebody, have some kind of little hit of enjoyment, or eat something, look at something. So seeing this in terms of rather short-term and unsatisfactory and ultimately self-defeating means of escaping from life as it is right now. And we need to develop that ability to be in the present moment and to learn from life and to learn how to deal with all these negative mental states that arise. And the more you do it, then the better you get, the more experience you have, the more skillful means you have. Then how can I bring up, what kind of wholesome dhammas can I bring up in my life? Well, patience. So I've got to go on a long meeting today or a long journey, and this really, rather than saying, oh, it's going to be so boring, it's going to be so hot, it's going to be so this and so that, and your mind's going round and round and all the things you don't like about what you've got to do today, and you just make yourself miserable, and you make yourself just a puppet or the prey of what's going on. You don't take any responsibility. It's because things are like that, I'm like this. It doesn't follow. Yeah, things are like that for sure. Not shutting our eyes to all the problems and the difficulties and the injustices and so on and so forth. Not saying, never mind. They're saying, right now, you know, what's the best response? Or what's the best way to take care of my mind? So in busy social situations, like metta bhavana is really good. Sharing, spreading feelings of loving kindness. Now that's a very flexible practice, and one you can do almost anywhere. Please understand that loving kindness just doesn't mean, oh, may everybody be happy, and just sort of spreading this kind of pink flowery cloud of love in all directions. It doesn't work like that. It's not really possible. Because if it's the pink, flowery, hallmark kind of metta, you know, then What happens when you see someone who's acting in a really nasty way? You know, just can't do it, and you don't want to do it either. You know, it's like he's hurting other people. He or she is acting in a very very selfish and aggressive and nasty way. Why on earth would I wish such a person to be happy? You know, can't do it. Don't want to do it. But that's a misunderstanding of metta. Metta means you wish. It's caring for your own heart, but it's a practice which must be imbued with wisdom. So if you see someone who's acting very aggressively, for instance, then you ask yourself, what kind of well-being could I wish that person? Well, I wish that person could experience the happiness of a mind free from aggression. Or that person's very selfish, self-centered, egotistical. May that person know the joy of unselfishness. That person's so jealous, you know. May that person experience the happiness of sympathetic joy. See? So the particular mental trait, the particular behavior which you find so difficult to deal with, rather than being a bhāta metta, is what focuses the metta. You think, wouldn't it be wonderful if that person who's always so critical, you know, knows the fault in everything and everybody and wants to tell everybody else as well from morning till night. Wouldn't it be so wonderful if that person could experience the joy of forgiveness and see the good side of people? And just imagine, oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Oh, if only that person could realize that. And so immediately, you know, your mind is just so kind of harsh and resistant and upset and feeling, you know, why, what karma did I create in a past life that I have to live with people like this? You know? Or have to work with people like this, you know, then it becomes a vehicle for opening. And see, everything is workable. This is the basic position. There's nothing that's not workable. It may not be complete liberation, but there's always something that you can do. It's just the interest and the commitment and the effort to see life as an education. And to be educating ourselves in every area. So this is everything is a challenge to this. You know, it's so easy just to suffer and blame people and say, I'm miserable because he did this or she did that or this happened. Or the other day I was in Palo Alto and with a few people, four here and one or two others, and we were, and this lady, and she recounted this really painful experience she had. It's an African-American woman who had been on a meditation retreat. And meditation retreats tend to be like 90-95% middle-class white people in America, don't they? And so she was a black American woman. And in the course of a guided meditation, the meditation teacher made a comment which was disparaging of African Americans, and she immediately sort of came out of whatever state of calm, and she was so hurt and so outraged by this that she still, you know, it was still affecting her now, quite some time afterwards. And the teacher did admit his fault and ask for forgiveness, but still. So I felt as a male and a monk certainly, but as a man, someone who wasn't there and who's never experienced what it'd be like to be an African American woman in it wasn't for me to give her some advice, but there were two elderly African American women there, really very strong, impressive women. And one of them said, you know, I was an orphan from the age of 7, brought up in an orphanage, but my grandfather used to come teach me sometimes. And he taught me something when I was a small girl that I never forgot. He said, girl, he said, there's nobody in this world better than you are. And you're not better than anyone else in this world. And she said that, I just remembered that all my life. And whenever I met the racial prejudice or people treating me meanly, I just remember that. And I thought that was such a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I thanked her. I said, I'm going to tell lots of other people about what you said today, so it will go further. And this is, it's not, I would say, from a Buddhist point of view, it's not quite there. But it's a very beautiful, a memorable thing to say. And she said it with such humility and such, it was so beautiful. I was really glad that I was there to hear that. But from a Buddhist point of view, to say, you would add, third point of view, that you're not on the same level as anybody else either. Because conceit, you can take, there's three kinds of conceit. I'm superior to you, I'm inferior to you, I'm equal to you. And it's that I'm equal to you, which is the one which we tend, especially in a sort of egalitarian society, we don't tend to see as a form of conceit. But the moment that you set yourself up as something compared to others, then you're in the world of conceit. Now, the ability to come to the present moment, you know, with a lot of this, just be in the now, you know, it's like be here now, as if it's the goal. You can be here now, everything's going to be okay. You know, you can eat an orange and you can do all these kind of things and be really happy. But the point is, what I would like to say is that the present moment is to carry on, expand on this education training analogy. The present moment is the classroom. Okay, that you learn about life in a direct, non-discursive, non-speculative, direct and life-transforming way when you can dwell awake, bright, clear, still in the present moment. And at that time, everything is teaching you. You learn so much. You observe so much. Understanding of things which if you read in a philosophy, book of philosophy or something, you would think, you'd close it after a page and think, this is too, I can't understand this. But when you're bright, awake, aware in the present moment, you learn this stuff. It's only when you try to articulate it afterwards, you realize, wow, that's really profound. But at the time you don't, it's just kind of normal. It's just this, it's just, then you realize, yeah, that's really, never thought about that before. Or I did, but it was, you know, as I've been saying since I came to the States, you know, our communication, our ability to communicate with others expands exponentially and is exploding, our communication with ourself becomes poorer and poorer, and we lack this awareness of what's going on. You know, we know the news, you know, what's happening in Thailand or what's happening in England or something, you know, within a flash. And yet things that are, you know, old news going on in our own heart and our own body, we still haven't heard it because we're always looking elsewhere, always looking for something new, something more, something exciting, something stimulating, anything more. And so coming to the present moment, we begin to notice, oh, yeah, you know, a simple thing. If you're in the present moment and suddenly a thought pops up. And at that moment, you notice that the moment that a thought arises in your mind, there is no sense of a thinker. And that sense of being the thinker arises conditioned by the thought, not the other way around. Common sense says you have to have someone who thinks before you can think. It's obvious. But direct experience says that's not the case. There's the thought arising, conditioned phenomena. It's a trigger, thought arises, and then there's a sense of ownership. So is that true? Have you noticed that? if you have, then suddenly a lot of this stuff about anatta and emptiness and all this kind of stuff which you've been reading about and furrowing your brow about and thinking you maybe you understand, you say, that's it. You know, there's just this flow of phenomena. There's the acquisition of this flow and this sense of ownership and self and other that rises moment by moment. So, people of other religious traditions say, in Buddhist view, when was the world created? How long ago? Do you accept the Bible view of a few thousand years, or you and these sort of Big Bang people, and as Buddhists we say, right now. This is when the world's created. It's created right now, and now, and now, and now. It's created moment by moment. We create the world, and for that reason, we realize that the creation of the world is not a fixed and necessary thing. We can transcend that, and this is the liberation that the Buddhist training provides, or can provide. So, it's not a teaching of adopting certain beliefs and attitudes and dogmas and forcing all the doubts out of your mind and trying to reinforce the things that you believe so you feel safe and stable. It's just bringing your mind to the present moment and looking and observing. And your interest in that and your ability to do it will be conditioned very largely by the care and the attention you give to the quality of your actions and speech in your relations with those around you and your families and your communities. Because when you, Thai people here, most of you will know that when people act in very immoral ways, they're drinking, they're gambling, the last thing they want to do is go and see a monk, because they don't want to hear. Because when you, if you're acting and living in a rearing, a monk gives a talk, he's... it's like a dagger in your heart, and is it? And he's saying, he's telling me off. I know he is. I know he knows all about me, and it's that was for me again. You see, so after a while, people don't want to go and see monks and listen to Dhamma talks, and that's just external. Internally, the last thing you want to do is be with yourself. If you're not acting well, you don't want to be with yourself, do you? And how difficult it is to be with yourself anyway. I mean, in all, most, almost all civilized countries have abolished capital punishment. But in those countries that have, then what's the worst thing they can do to you? The absolute horror is put you in solitary confinement. To be with yourself is the most terrible punishment for most human beings. And so it doesn't have to be. It's quite the opposite. Learning to be with yourself and learning from experience is what gives you that real sense of a compass and a direction and a sense of what's right and wrong, good and bad and wholesome and unwholesome, not as a philosophy, but as something that is an articulation of direct experience. So I would like to end my talk at this point. Thank you.
Please pay respect to Prajan together. Arahang
Sama. Yang mai chok. I say, just forget that. It's not so late, so if anybody has any questions or would like to dispute and refute, correct me. Clara, yes?
I just have a... Okay. Yeah, I would just like to ask, what is the best time to meditate?
Right now. The best time. I think that the best time to meditate is early in the morning, first thing in the morning. And a lot of people sort of lose their enthusiasm for meditation because they tend to meditate before they go to sleep at night, and by which time, you know, they're run down and tired already, and they don't really, and it becomes just kind of like an empty ritual, and especially if they sit on their bed or anywhere near a pillow, and then after a while, and then sitting meditation last thing at night without any real foundation of meditation can lead to some very bad habits, because you tend to get sleepy, and then you get into this habit of associating meditation with sleepiness. So some kind of meditation before sleeping is a good idea, definitely. For one thing, it'll prevent bad dreams, and you're relaxed, and you sleep better than if you're going to sleep very anxious and stressed out. So it's a good thing. But the main meditation practice, I think, should be first thing in the morning, because you're refreshed. You don't have anything, hopefully, very much in your mind. And outside, it's quiet. It's a good time, cool, good time to meditate. But what's extremely important is that coming out of the meditation, you observe the effects of the meditation on your mind and heart during the day. Because if you start to observe that you feel a little bit more grounded, a little bit more patient, a little bit more forgiving, a little bit more present, and so on, then you start to get confident. Yeah, this is really worthwhile. And this is worth giving some time to every day. And you begin to see some definite changes taking place. So long-term motivation, you know, you have to see some positive results from effort. And meditators often will set the bar too high. You know, they want to see some sort of special experience, but come down a bit and just look in daily life. And if you're just a little bit more patient and kind and sensitive to others, and a little bit more aware of how your behavior is impacting other people, that's a sign that meditation is starting to have some transformative effect on your life. I would suggest to also at the beginning to make some kind of a time determination. So do this for 3 months every morning, whatever, and keep a diary or a record, so at the end of that you can really see if there are any changes, and to really to give you that willingness to just to keep at it. Because at the end of the day, as they say, it's more that constancy and just being very patient and keeping at it every single day, rather than what some people get really enthusiastic, go on a meditation retreat and I'm gonna get back, I'm gonna meditate every day, and it's like, you know, the clock, the watches people used to have before digital, you know, just sort of goes slower and slower and slower, and so you start off every day, and it's every 2 days, and then from an hour, it's half an hour and 20 minutes, and, you know, and then suddenly it's all gone away. So steady Eddie, you know, just keep very, very, it doesn't have to be a long period of time, but consistency is really key. Yeah.
Thank you.
I had always thought that Kanti was translated as forbearance, so that forbearance was the highest virtue. I'm not sure what forbearance means, but maybe something like forgiveness.
Yeah, I actually prefer, in my own works of translation, I use forbearance, but I would consider forbearance and patient endurance as meaning the same thing. I mean, some people, particularly people who speak English as a second language, kind of a bit puzzled by forbearance, and they don't, because it's really a kind of Charles Dickens 19th century kind of word rather than one that many of us use these days, isn't it? But forbearance is, I would say, whether we use patient endurance or forbearance, the idea there, the essence of it, is this patient peaceful coexistence with the unpleasant.
And the other one, if samadhi is those things that you said, I would have thought almost all the things you said would apply to sila. behaving in those ways, the training of the heart is more like sila, or the right motivation for sila.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to point out that these things are inseparable. The particular feature, the defining feature of sila, is the intention to refrain from certain actions and certain kinds of speech. So it's a volitional practice. So we recognize the value and also the limitations of volition. Let's say, you know, we can say, no matter how angry I am with you, I promise you, I make a commitment, I would never hit you. I would never swear at you, even though I'm boiling inside. I'm not going to repress that. I'm going to be fully conscious of it, but I'm not going to express it. So this middle way between repression and expression. And so you can feel safe because I'm not going to hurt you that way. So this, but I can't say, I promise you, you know, I'm a good Buddhist and I'm gonna be kind and loving towards you, whatever you do and whatever you say in future, because I want to be a good Buddhist. That would be foolish, because you can't prevent the arising of negative mental states with volition. The sphere of work for volition is action, speech. So for the role of dealing with negative mental states, then the key practice is cultivation of its opposite. So in the case of anger, then cultivating loving kindness and developing a new habit in the mind. One of the principles is if we have a, if we put out a glass of milk for a cat, you know, and the cat doesn't, and then the cat comes every day, and then one day you don't put the milk out anymore, the cat still comes back a few times because you might change your mind. But eventually the cat realizes, no milk here, goes somewhere else. And so on the sila level, as we refrain from the volition to harm again and again and again, that volition starts to atrophy because it's never acted upon. And at the same time, from the inner, we are developing these thoughts of loving kindness and forgiveness. So working both from the outside and the inside together, then this negative mental state becomes extremely weak. But to cut it off, you need the wisdom on the level of vipassana to see it as simply a mental state that arises and passes away as a condition rather than who you are. So these three things work together in that way. For prisoners or non-meditators.
Why is the emphasis practice for the forest monastery is emphasis on being in isolation?
No, I was pointing to the fact that for someone who has acted or acts in very unskillful and harmful ways, some people say, he's done bad things, and look, he's so rich and wealthy and famous, and tamchua deidi, and reject this the law of karma. And the Buddha never said that, you know, acting immorally means that you won't ever get rich or famous or anything. But one of the immediate results of unskillful action is that people find it almost impossible to be with themselves without distraction. So from the point of view of somebody in the world who has no spiritual aspirations, so what? But the moment that you have some kind of right view and you have that aspiration, then you see that's horrible, that's a hell. So if someone who has that kind of mind is put in isolation, it's awful. But if you have pure sila and you're interested in meditation And observing your mind in great, with subtlety and detail, isolation can be wonderful. So it's whether or not it's voluntary and it's dependent on the person and the intention. So I mean, it's monks, when they hear about people in solitary confinement, say, I could do that. That wouldn't be so bad.
I have a question about the pure sila. Let's say if you have a pure sila, then you're recognizing that other people is breaking the sila. You're not thinking that you're better, but you're just recognizing that there might not be a good person. Will that make your sila obsolete as well? Because, I mean...
No, it's not that it makes it obsolete or completely zero, you know, nullifies the sila. But it's an imperfection, or sullies the sila, if you like. So it's a more subtle, you know, it's the next level of training. But I really wanted to point out that sila is a very complex and integral part of this whole training or education. I think in the West, this whole idea about, you know, being non-judgmental, you know, it's like a virtue which is considered very important. But in Buddha Dhamma, we would say, yeah, if someone's acting in an unskillful way, there is a recognition that person is creating really bad karma. And so then we have like Brahma Viharas. You know, you don't want someone to be creating bad karma, so you have compassion. And you think, is there something that I could do or to say to make this person realize the foolishness of their action or to change? Is our relationship such that person would listen to me? What would be the right time and right place? What would be the right words? Then maybe you get you feel that, yeah, this isn't, that person is just not going to listen to me right now. And so you say, well, then I dwell in equanimity and just keep my mind calm. And then whenever anything changes and I can do something to help that person, then I will. So there's a distinction between thinking I'm superior to that person, but if you have a recognition, oh, I'm so fortunate that I've heard this teaching and I'm practicing in this way, and you feel sad and compassionate for someone who's still acting in ways that's making their own life very painful and making... and creating pain for those around them.
But I mean, eventually you don't want to think as you and me, right?
Yeah, but that's the very highest level. But this, in the sila level, it's quite coarse, you know. You know, like when people give up smoking and they see people smoking, that's so gross, you know, that kind of, you know. Or someone who's been very overweight and then they lose all the weight, they put a lot of effort into losing weight, and then they just can't bear it when they see those self-indulgent, obese people. Why don't they pull themselves together? Yeah, so gross and disgusting. You know that. So we create this kind of. It's just something to. It's normal and natural, you know, but something to recognize and to let go of.
Anybody else? Please take the mic from me.
Thank you for coming here today. This is all pretty new to me. And I grew up studying Taekwondo and learning how to meditate at a very young age. So it's coming pretty easily to me. However, I'm a little bit of a news junkie, and we live in a violent world right now, and I'm just curious to know, from what my wife has exposed me to, it seems to be very peaceful and very loving. However, I'm having a hard time reconciling the monks in Burma and the violence that's going on there now, along with the Shaolin monks who practice martial arts. I was wondering if you could just try to explain what's going on there to a layman.
Okay, yeah. Well, the different schools of Buddhism and different ideas of what a monk is and what a monk's role is or should be. So I'll try to simplify as much as possible. In this school of Buddhism, which called Theravada, which we find in Thailand and Sri Lanka and Cambodia and Burma and so on, the idea of the monastic order has traditionally been that the monastic order is a unifier in the society, that monks don't take on any political affiliation, they don't make overt political statements, they don't identify themselves with political parties or even social reform parties. And one reason for that is that people of every political persuasion can come to the monastery. So whether they're rich or poor, or Republican or Democrat, or red or yellow or whatever, then the idea is the moment you walk in the monastery, you put all that, you leave all that at the gate, and you're all Buddhists, you're all students of the Buddha or of the Dhamma. That's the ideal. Now, you could see what would happen if monks become identified with a particular political party or a political program. Then all those people who were affiliated with different political parties would feel alienated from the Sangha. And perhaps if they got in power, they might see that the monastic order was a danger to them, might start passing laws to suppress the monastic order. So in the long term, it would be very dangerous for the institution, the monastic institution, to be involved in politics. Plus, of course, it would probably be the case that in a monastery, not everybody would have the same political views. So, you know, the abbot might be a Democrat and the vice abbot a Republican, you know, and you'd have everything would become very conflicted and the monastic harmony would fall apart. But that's not to say that monks should not stand up for Buddhist values. But they speak more on a general level. This is the Buddha. The Buddha said that violence is always wrong and there's no such thing as the means justifies the ends in Buddhist teachings. And whatever your justification should be, hurting others is always wrong. And so people can take this and apply it to particular situations. Now, this role of the Sangha or the monastic order in society has been pretty well upheld in Thailand for the past many hundred years. And that's due largely to the close relationship between the monastic order and the monarchy. And secondly, and most importantly, I would think, is that Thailand never became a colony of any of the Western powers. What is now Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, became French colonies, Burma, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, India were all British colonies. Thailand was a buffer between them. In those other countries, the relationship between the secular power and the Sangha was cut. And in some cases, particularly in Sri Lanka, there was a repression of Buddhism, quite a violent repression, first by the Portuguese and then by the Dutch before the British took over in the 19th century. And British are a lot more, you know, sort of indirect, and you know, if you wanted a good job, then you have to become a Christian or whatever. But they don't actually make you do that. But when the time became ripe for independence movements to throw out the colonial powers, inevitably people looked to the leaders, the historical leaders of the society, which were the monks. So in Sri Lanka and Burma, the monks were leaders of the independence movement and attained a political role which they didn't relinquish after independence. And also the idea of what a monk should be, how a monk should behave, was very much conditioned by that. So for lay Buddhists in Sri Lanka or Burma, monks being involved in political protests and so on is quite normal, and they're accepted by them, and it's not in Thailand. So there was a kind of weird situation, you remember a few years ago, where the Burmese monks were on the streets protesting against the military government and were being beaten up and tortured and killed, and people all over the world were horrified by that and were calling upon the Burmese. And yet, how is it that the Buddhist country next door, the Burma, same school of Buddhism, same kind of Buddhism, almost completely quiet? And you know, part of that was for more political reasons, but on the part of Buddhists, it's just that lay Buddhists in Thailand just feel, what are those monks doing? That's not their role. That's not their job. Monks shouldn't be doing that. So once you get into that world, then that's the kind of thing that happens to you. So there was a sense of compassion and for the monks individually. But this lack of sympathy for their methods because of the idea of Sangha and the role of a monk, which was in fact laid down by the Buddha, and as for various social, historical, cultural reasons, being able to be upheld in Thailand as is not in those other countries. So that's the difference between Thailand and Burma. As far as Shaolin, and this is a different school of Buddhism, and the Shaolin temple is a bit kind of unique anyway. You know, it's become sort of an entertainment industry in many ways around the world. And but in this school of Buddhism, then monks being involved in martial art training and giving martial arts performances around the world and so on, that would be considered to be would be breaking the monks' precepts, and we wouldn't do that. So there are different schools of Buddhism and different sects and different ideas of Buddhist monasticism. Is a big topic.
I wanted to ask you a question about intense emotions, because
sorry, I can't see who am I talking
to? I'm here.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay.
You touched upon negative mental states quite a bit this evening, and with regards to people that suffer from clinical depression and basically there's an organic brain disorder, and I wonder what your thoughts were, or would you be saying that the mind is more powerful and therefore the brain can, or the cortex, would therefore be able to control the amygdala, which results in these sort of borderline disorders?
Well, I think that a lot of the research on, recent research on neuroplasticity made possible by development of fMRI technology and so on, has supports the Buddhist view that there is a two-way movement here. Certainly you can't deny that brain damage, say through an accident or genetic or whatever, will have an effect on the mind. But the mind is not merely, you know, a byproduct or what they call epiphenomena of the chemical changes in the brain. And the mental training has an effect on both the structure and the function of the brain. For instance, the frontal cortex you're referring to thins through age. And what they found is that people who have been meditating from a young age, their cortex, the thickness of their cortex at 60 is equivalent to the cortex of a non-meditator at 40. So this is a case where the thinning of the cortex is affected by meditation. This is one of many, many cases. The Yeah, so there are all kinds of studies going on now with long-term meditators, Tibetan monks involved in these brain scans and seeing how cultivation of positive emotions can, and meditation can affect mood and brain function. You're probably aware of the what do they call SSR? Is the mood affecting medication?
Pardon?
SSRI. That you can get the compared with the effect of placebo. Placebo affects 80% of the effect of those medicines, which suggests that a lot of it is coming from the mind rather than the brain. And I think that, you know, that idea that the brain is like this, therefore the mind is like that, doesn't stand up to analysis. And that we know, on moving away from the brain a little bit, that if we're very stressed out and tense or worried, then that has an effect on our immune system, or it can create, or very simply, some people get, when they get very stressed out, then they get diarrhea, for instance. I mean, this is a physical phenomena being affected by it. It is so common and obvious, you know, that happens again and again, that our mental states affect our physiology. I mean, that first the brain. And one of the reasons why this secular mindfulness movement is expanding so rapidly and is being accepted in so many different fields now is due to certain medical studies. And one of them, published I think in Britain originally, compared different treatments of depression. And in like an initial bout of depression, first depression, then the different kinds of treatments, whether the drugs or therapy or so on, pretty much the same. But where you see a huge difference is in chronic depression. And in chronic depression, the treatment called MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, is way more effective than any other treatment. And it's the clinical tests of this now out there, peer reviewed, and it's generally accepted that this is not some Buddhist or some radical theory, but there's hard evidence supporting this. So this is a mindfulness-based approach to depression, which has measurable and quite remarkable effects on incidence of chronic depression. So I would say that's, you know, one reason, and I think it's one that gives us a lot of hope that, you know, we're not the prisoner of our chemicals, as it were. And even with genes, I mean, there was a period, wasn't there, where we're getting into this very mechanistic kind of idea, we are our genes, you know, you've got this gene and this happens. But now I'm not claim to be a scientist, but from what I gather, they found that a simple analogy would be like genes have an off and on switch, and the way your surroundings and your upbringing and so on determine or condition whether or not that gene is switched on. So it's not that you say because you've got such a gene, you're going to be this way or that way. And one experiment that I did read about, it was before, they don't do these experiments on humans, obviously, it's done on rhesus monkeys, where there is one particular genetic mutation. And rhesus monkeys who have this genetic mutation tend to act in very aggressive ways. So they got a number of these monkeys, and in one group, they were given very warm and close maternal affection and attention, and the others were abandoned and lacked that kind of affection in the first 2 months of their life. The ones that lacked affection and touching is very important. They went on to manifest these aggressive tendencies whereas the rhesus monkeys who were surrounded with love and affection and touching and so on in the first couple of months of their life didn't, even though they had the same genes. So these kinds of studies are coming out more and more now to show that it's this mixture of what we call nature and nurture. It's not just one or the other.